One of the recurring themes, I think, of this conference is that over the past few years, our capabilities in the simulations and computations and the observations have all increased dramatically, but these improvements have largely been independent of each other. And we still need a way to bridge the gap, if you will, between the observations and the computations to really compare apples and apples instead of apples and oranges. That way we can really get the, I think that's the one way we can really get the most out of both the simulations and the observations. It'll help us really know what to look for in the observations and know how to either prove or disprove a simulation or a theory. So this talk is really going to focus on one analysis tool for bridging this gap, this ray tracing analysis that's done in the Kerr metric to take some QPO model and produce something that can be directly compared with observations. And I'm just going to show a few examples of how we apply this analysis and then hopefully talk about where to go from there. So Ron just told us a whole lot about the RxDE observations of QPOs. They occur over a large range of frequency, and they appear to be predominantly in this power loss state. There's a bunch of different spectra of in the steep power law state. So really any viable QPO model is going to have to address not only where the QPOs exist in frequency, but their amplitudes, their width of the QPOs, and also all the other spectral evidence we have about the QPO. So we really need not just the QPO model, but a reasonable emission model in order to compare the simulations with the data. Another thing Ron mentioned is that many of these high-frequency QPO systems appear to have multiple peaks with commensurate frequencies. And then he also showed, you saw a page full of new QPO theories to explain this 3-to-2 frequency ratio. But again, we can't really pick one theory over the other without an objective method of comparing them. And what better objective method than comparing with observations, since we're fairly certain that those are what's really happening. So the ray tracing method, a little schematic of how this works, is you have your QPO model is going to be defined on some fixed coordinate grid represented here around the black hole. Then you trace the photons from a distant observer through the Kerr metric around the black hole. Along each photon path, you tabulate the photon position and momentum so that you can then go back and solve the radiative transfer equation along the photon path projected on top of this QPO model. So in practice, it's just you take the photon path, you break it up into little pieces, and at each piece, then you have to define a local orthonormal frame in which you can solve the special relativistic radiative transfer equation. We do it that way because we're generally interested in the spectral intensity in some coordinate frame, whereas the emissivity and the absorption coefficients are generally going to be defined in the local rest frame of the fluid, which is like the primed frame here. So once you have the ray tracing and the fixed coordinate grid, you can start playing with your models. So the simplest model is really this geodesic hotspot model, which has been often used and certainly abused to just pick the frequencies that you see in the observations and pick some linear combinations of coordinate frequencies and try to match them up. And from that, you can say something about the radius of your disk or the radius of your hotspot and the spin of the black hole. So here's just one example specifically applicable to the 3-to-2 frequency ratios. You have a hotspot going around this dashed line is the ISCO, where the hotspot orbital frequency is going to be, is in this picture, 3 times the radial frequency. So it goes around 3 times for every one period between paracenter, apocenter, and back to paracenter. So this is what, with the ray tracing, this is what this hotspot model looks like. You see the hotspot going around, and at this inclination, it gives a pretty strong pulse due to the relativistic beaming once each orbit. So you just, this is 70 degree inclination to the viewer, where 90 degrees is edge on. So you, just characteristic set of peaks every orbital period, and then these peak amplitudes are going to be modulated by the radial frequency as it goes through paracenter and out. And as, for example, here, as the hotspot goes through paracenter, it's going to be moving faster, so you have a higher beaming factor and you get a stronger peak. And then that gives you light curves that look like that, and then power spectra, where you have a bunch of peaks at, like I said, you just have the peaks at the linear combinations of the coordinate frequencies. And then the relative amplitudes and widths of all those peaks are just functions of the hotspot parameters. So a related model is what we're calling the precessing ring model, which is actually very similar to what Chris was just talking about, except where it doesn't yet settle down into the Bardeen-Peterson disk, but you still have a ring of geodesic particles that are precessing out of the plane with respect to the black hole spin axis. And we've used this model to explain some recent observations by Miller and Homan of low-frequency QPOs from 1915. With these low-frequency QPOs, it's nice because you can get the actual phased resolve spectroscopy, and you see when you add up the iron lines at the high phases, you get a broad line, and when you add up the iron lines from the low phases, you get a narrower line. So the basic model we're trying to understand is something that gives broad lines at high peak at the high phase and a narrow line at the low phase. And that's exactly what you see in this precessing ring model. So here's the ring precessing around the black hole. Again, baseline 70 degrees, but since you have an inclined ring, you're going to get an effective inclination ranging from about 50 to 90 degrees. And as you see, as you go through the maximum of the light curve, you get the instantaneous line spectrum here, as it gets much broader at the peak because you're going to have extra blue shift from this side and extra red shift from this side. Another interesting feature of this emission geometry you see is this third horn, which is not really the third horn that Chris was just talking about, but it comes from the gravitational lensing. Here we'll stop right at the peak. So you get a blue shifted horn, a red shifted horn, and then this Einstein ring of magnification to pick out this third horn, which could be really exciting if we see this in the observations, possibly even in AGN observations, which wouldn't need such high timing resolution. Now those models were still basically just toy models where you're looking at geodesic test particles. Also, I wanted to show this hydrodynamic simulation by Rizzola's group in Italy, where we apply the same ray tracing analysis to a fully relativistic hydrodynamic simulation to just, it's really, I would call it a proof of principle idea that shows that you can take some tabulated set of data output from a 3D there's a 2D axisymmetric simulation, but some global hydro simulation, and you can convert what we think of as like the intrinsic variables of the simulation into an extrinsic variable of this modulated light curve to really compare with observations. And to conclude, I just want to give a plug for the future, as we're going to hear a lot tomorrow about more global MHD simulations. It seems more and more widely accepted that the MRI instability that's really driving these accretion disks. So here's just two snapshots I started working on with John Hawley and Julian Krolik of their MHD simulation. Starts off as a torus and then, you know, falls down into the disk, gaining a lot of structure. And this sort of ray tracing analysis can really be ideal for taking these giant global MHD simulations and somehow reducing them to a foreman that can be directly compared with observations.
Okay, questions, comments? Mike again.
First of all, let me say that you did a great job. I enjoyed this, the presentation and the diagnostic method that you're using. My question is about the some of the details of the radiative transfer problem that you solved. Do you assume an emission model? Can you tell us in a nutshell what do you do when you say you solve the radiative
transfer? That's easy because these models we use very simple emission model, whereas this proof of principle, if you will, where it's just like for the torus model, it's just optically thin line emission. So that's how you can see through the disk into this Einstein ring behind it. And then you're just using monochromatic emission to get that line profile. Give me half a second. I actually have another simulation of that same model, but now using a thermal emission model, where just, you know, some sort of black body with a Kramer opacity law, and here that's how your line spectrum is going to be moving. Of course, it's not really a line spectrum because you have a whole thermal emission, and you know, again, it's like a proof of principle to show that we can use more of a general emission and absorption models to see what these disks look like.
One of the questions I've always had about the QPO models is that we see from observations that the QPO modulates the hard component, and yet all these kind of ideas are how we modulate the disk component. Do you have any ideas how to get the QPO from the disk to the hard component?
Well, not only is the QPO in the hard component, but the whole state of the black hole is in the steep power law. So there's almost certainly some hot compact corona around the entire thing. So you have to think about how do you get the QPO to the corona. You're really good, probably propagating through a corona and then getting to the observer. I've done some calculations that actually show that this is not a good way of matching the QPO observations, because if anything, you're going to damp out the amplitudes by first going through the hot corona. So I'm going to say that it's not coming from a thermal disk getting upshifted through a corona, but rather you're probably looking at real, when we say hot spots on the disk, really talking about hot spots, really non-thermal, much hotter areas of radiation. And if you have like little knots in your disk, then it's reasonable that they're going to be significantly hotter than any sort of thermal profile.
What was the spin of the black hole in the cases?
This model actually right here is a Schwarzschild black hole. The the precessing ring, of course, has to have a spin or you wouldn't precess. This is, I think I used a 0.5 spin for this black hole. But
so I understand that you have quite a number of parameters you have to decide about before you run the simulations, right?
Okay. Well, for this one, you need a few. So you need the radius of this ring, the spin of the black hole, then the inclination of the black hole, and then the inclination of the ring with respect to the black hole. So that's four parameters, at least one of which we're going to say is the inclination of the binary. So then you're down to three, and then in order to match this precession frequency with the observations, that gives you a pretty strict limit on the radius, because there's only one radius that gives you that precession. So that gives you, you know, degeneracy between the radius of the ring and the spin of the black hole. And then you want to match the width of the iron line and the amplitude of the QPO. So in the end, you actually get a fairly well-constrained system.